I want to welcome you on behalf of the Madison Institute. I'm Connie Trinan, chairing the board of the Madison Institute, and we are just delighted that you are here to hear Reimagining Capitalism. Can democratic principles survive in our capitalist economy? Well, we are asking that question of Bill Greider tonight, so we'll let him answer that question for us. John Nichols is probably one of the best-known people in Madison. I think he probably can call three-quarters of us by our first names. And we of course, depend on him at the Cap Times, but he is everywhere. So he hardly needs much introduction, but I do want to say what some of you may not know is that he is one of the contributors, correspondent for The Nation magazine. And he is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, and that makes him a colleague of our speaker, Bill Greider, who is the foreign affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. How did they get all these good people? They've got lots of them, and we're delighted to have both of these men here tonight. And both of them are well-known authors, have written important books. I'm sure we will hear more about Bill Greider's books, but I want to be sure you all know about John Nichols' book about the S word. Very good essays having to do with the history of socialism and the elements of it. So we have important people here tonight, and I don't think that I should take any longer talking about it, and we'll just let them talk. So, John Nichols, we need to hear from you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, dear. No. I am unaccustomed to speaking in an enclosed setting without snow falling. And 50, 70, maybe 100,000 people. But I think we're rising to the Wisconsin level here because we have hit capacity and wonderful folks are coming in. And there are actually, you're certainly more than welcome to sit on the steps if you like, or even where you integrate in. So this is wonderful to have this great turnout. Let me ask you one question right up front. Could there be a better soul than Connie Trinan? That issue is settled. Where's Ed Garvey? Where's Garvey? Where is he? There, way, way back there. You can gather however you want, wherever you want. You can say what you want. It's a free country, sort of, still. But I will tell you that I've said this for the better part of 15 years, but now I say it with more pride, more passion, or more certainty than ever. Ed Garvey is and will always be my governor of Wisconsin. And I note also, sitting modestly way back up in the nosebleed section is the former president of the AFL-CIO for Wisconsin, David Newby, who's been such an ally, such a comrade. More back surgeries than I can describe, and yet he slept on the marble at the Capitol. So I am not here to give any kind of speech. I'm here to do the coolest thing anybody can do, which is to introduce their hero. And I think I can just keep my adulation at a controllable level. But I will tell you that I have been reading Bill Greider since I was younger than anyone in this room. And I notice we have some good young folks here, so I'm glad of that. But Bill Greider taught me how to be a journalist. And there are two critical elements of it. One, you do have to tell the truth. That is a requirement. I know. It's amazing. It's not a requirement at Fox, trust me. But you do have to tell the truth. But the other thing is, you have to tell the truth. And that's the second part that is so much more complex than the first. Because every journalist says, oh, yes, of course, we tell the truth. Well, do you tell the truth about the economy? Well, no, if we told the people the truth about the economy, why, they'd come to the Capitol in February and surround it with hundreds of thousands of people in protest. They'd occupy Wall Street. They would get very, very angry. And so we don't tell them the whole truth. We just tell them a little tiny bit, right? The economy collapses. We're threatened. We're going to have the bailout of the banks, right? And CNBC is on saying, keep your money in the markets. Keep your money in the markets. And we have to turn to Jon Stewart to be the only guy who says, well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. And so this notion that you're supposed to tell the truth, but you actually do tell the truth, is something that Greider has taught a generation of journalists. And what I mean by that is he has gone after the big institutions, the core institutions of this country. He's dug into them. He's figured out what's going on. And then he's come back with a report from the other side. Now, this requires him to wear a suit and tie all the time and to dress like one of those Washingtonians. But he worked for the Washington Post, and he learned how to do it there. But then he made that incredible leap, right, from the Washington Post to Rolling Stone, taking the Hunter Thompson seat for U.S. political coverage. That was a big leap. And he doesn't cut the Hunter Thompson style in every way. And yet, Greider was able to go to Rolling Stone, reach out to a generation of young people and help them to understand the importance of politics. There are more people who learn their politics from Greider and Rolling Stone than Karl Marx or Adam Smith combined. And no, I'm very, very serious. And that's a big deal. So this guy's done a lot of stuff. But I'm going to tell you one little story. And this is a story from Paul Wellstone. And I was slightly unsettled in Paul Wellstone's last kind of 2 years of the Clinton term, where he became a very passionate defender of President Clinton. Because I had my gripes with President Clinton, and I didn't think he was right on trade policy, because I had read Greider's very good book, One World Ready or Not, in which he explained to everybody that this free trade thing wasn't going to work. Unfortunately, Clinton didn't read that book in time. And neither, as it turns out, did Obama. So I was interested in why Wellstone, who was a good friend and a good comrade to many of us, why he became decidedly more sympathetic to Bill Clinton. And I said, one time we're sitting in his office, I said, what was it? What was it? And he said, well, there was a tragedy when some incident in Israel, and Clinton had to fly over to Israel. So, you know, Clinton and Wellstone weren't all that close, but Clinton, you know, went through the Rolodex, found the Jewish senators, and said, you know, come on, going to Israel, you got to come with me. So Wellstone gets on the plane, flies to Israel for the ceremony, the event, whatever it was. And then they're flying back on Air Force One. Now, Wellstone had a worse back than David Newby. And, you know, he could not sit in an airplane seat for 15 hours. It didn't work for him. So when he's on a plane, everybody else is asleep. Wellstone would go back to the galley of the plane, and he'd just stand there, because his back's hurting, so he'd lean against the galley and read a book. So on this flight back, everybody in the plane is asleep, and he's there, he's reading, and I hope I got to get the title of this one right, because I read it, but now I want to make sure, your book on the Pentagon.
Fortress America.
So Wellstone's reading Fortress America, leaning against the galley in Air Force One. And the only other person, although presumably a pilot, but beyond the pilot, the only other person who is awake on the plane comes strolling back to the galley, and it's Bill Clinton, wearing his sweats. And he's like, Paul, what are you reading there? And he goes, oh, you would not. It's a new book by Bill Greider. It's Fortress America. And Clinton goes, oh, Fortress America. I thought that's a good book. I thought Greider did a really good job in it, but he was a little soft on some of the defense contractors. Not kidding, I'm making this up. So he goes, he's a little soft on some of the defense contractors. And I kind of thought it petered out at the end a little bit. I was looking for something more there, you know? And Wellstone's like, so you already read this book? I said, I just got it. And he said, oh, yeah, I read it. And he says, but I didn't think it was as good as Secrets of the Temple. And Wellstone's like, wow, that's good. I'm glad you're reading Greider. And Clinton goes, yeah, you know, in Secrets of the Temple, boy, you know, there was, some of the notes at the back, there was one footnote that Greider did, and he started going into, like, minutia of the book. And Wellstone said, that was the point at which I decided that while I disagreed with Clinton on many issues, the guy, any president of the United States who's reading Bill Greider, first off, shouldn't be impeached, and probably should be encouraged to at least try one more shot. So if to the extent that Bill Clinton finished his term, it was probably because of Greider. And I don't think I ever told you that story. But
I disown that story right now.
No. It was to the good. But this is Greider, once you're a Greider reader, once you're into it, if somebody else is, you realize you're connecting with somebody on a more serious level. And to me, the book that will always matter the most is Secrets of the Temple. And we are now in the Greider moment, right? Because now we have Ron Paul activists and, you know, socialists standing next to each other in Zuccotti Park between all those temples of capital down by Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement, bringing together libertarians and socialists, all of them saying, we've got to do something about the Federal Reserve, because Greider was right. It is undermining the whole of our democracy. That's a pretty cool thing. And so we are in a Greiderian moment. And I'll just add one thing here. I don't know where Mary Batari is. There, Mary Batari from Center for Media and Democracy, who is my wife, but was also yesterday appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to sit with Joseph Stiglitz and Jeffrey Sachs on the new committee that Sanders has put together to come up with a way to democratize the Federal Reserve. So a quarter century after you wrote Secrets of the Temple, we've got a U.S. senator who's actually trying to put it into play. This is Greider's moment. He has written such absolutely brilliant books. Most of you have read them all. His latest book, Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country, is an incredibly sweet and wonderful book, except for the part where he makes fun of Paul Krugman. And, and notes that when he wrote One World Ready or Not, Paul Krugman said, oh, Greider's crazy, he's way out there, he's criticizing free trade. And now Paul Krugman says, I should have listened to Greider. Do you have some questions?
Thank you.
Do you have some questions?
You going to hold the microphone?
Got that microphone.
I'm sorry, we've had difficulty with microphones. We always seem to do that. And I hope that you all could hear properly. And we have taped this, and we will have it as a link on the Madison Institute's website. We're going to have Joe Elder act as a microphone stand.
And
have been praising people for great things, we must say that tomorrow night, Joe Elder is being honored at the concourse for 50 years of teaching at the University of Wisconsin.
Thank
So after 50 years, one holds the microphone.
I'm up to it.
So we would like to have you come down to speak in the microphone. I think that helps when we're recording things, too. And I think that this microphone is really better than that one, Bill.
I'll use it.
Let's try it anyway. Do people have questions?
What you're saying, this guy.
Well, I'm waiting for people to come down to me and talk into this mic here. I think if you make a cue, I think
Kelly,
it's the easiest way to do it.
I'll
hold it up
in
front of your mouth.
My question would be...
When you ask your question, will you please give us your name? And if there's anything like you come from California or something like that, you can tell us that.
Let's let people shuffle for 1 second here, though. Tell you what, while everybody's shuffling around, let me start Grider out here. You took your title from the slogan of George McGovern's 1972 presidential race. Now, I don't know history that well, but I believe McGovern lost on these ideas. What has changed since 72?
Well, as a crackpot historian and reporter, Mike is working, yeah. I reject that analysis. That was the Ben Wattenberg neoconservative analysis of the 1972 election. I'll tell you this story. This is a diversion. I mentioned to some Joe and some others earlier that I grew up in a very Republican town in a very Republican city, Cincinnati, Ohio, and my parents, as far as I could tell, were both Republicans. Their family used to be Whigs earlier in history, and they shocked me in 1964 by announcing, my father announced, he was going to vote for Lyndon Johnson. And I said, you are? And why? He said, well, this Goldwater guy is crazy, and he's going to get us into war. So they both voted for Lyndon Johnson, and then it got to 1972, and I was covering George McGovern's campaign for the Washington Post, and I called my folks one time from the road and said, you know, how are you doing? And I said, I'm out with McGovern now for the duration. And my father said, well, McGovern's my man. And he was sincere, and my mother's on the extension phone, and she said, well, he's not my man. And I said, who are you for? She said, I'm for Shirley Chisholm. So those are my political roots. But I ran into McGovern, who's a wonderful, wonderful person and politician. A couple years ago when I was working on this book, and I said, I'm going to title this book Come Home, America. And that's sort of sticking my chin out. I knew that. And wouldn't help the sales probably, but I wanted to do it. And he said, well, that, you know, wasn't mine. It came from Martin Luther King. And sure enough, in a sermon in 1967, the year before he died, somewhere in Alabama, he's a wonderful, you can find it on the internet, this wonderful sort of meditation on come back to our roots, come back to our morality, etc. He was talking mainly about the war, but it fits our time, certainly.
Okay, I think we're ready. Name?
My name is Bruce Felk. I'm from Michigan. My question is, you're both journalists, you both talk about telling the truth. Don't you think we need an Occupy the Media movement that will go into Fox News and go into all these news outlets that are not telling us the truth, because I don't think the American people have enough information yet, good information. We can't have an honest discussion unless we're all working from the same set of facts. So I guess I would like your comment on what we have to do to fix the media, because I think we have to fix the media if we're going to fix our country.
I love that idea. I hope somebody is going to pass it on to the people in the movement, all of the movements. Because I can be an advisor on that action. Nonviolently, of course. We don't want to hurt anybody. I keep going back to the populace. Larry Goodwin, the historian's great book, The Populist Moment, describes this. the rise of the agrarian revolt and the fact that they had to do it for themselves. They had no choice. At the height of that movement, they had something like 70 or 80 newspapers around the country. And they had magazines, they published books, they had a speakers bureau, which sent farmers all over the Midwest and South to explain what the problem was and why the bankers were crushing farmers and so forth and so on. Look, I'm for throwing mud balls at the big media, and I'd be glad to join in. But I do think we can do a good deal of that for ourselves. The internet actually gives us a capacity to communicate far beyond anything people had in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and it's not perfect, but I can imagine a kind of pass along news bureau that is coming from you all. You don't need reporters to tell what's happening. And this movement, and John knows this better than I do, but as I read the intentions of this movement that started in Lower Manhattan, they are going to stick to that principle that we don't need or want the major institutions to claim territory of ours. We're going to create our own new spaces, and I think they have the capacity, both the courage and inventiveness to do that. So I'm basically an optimist on the question of communication.
Yes, my name is Paul Engelman. Tammy Baldwin, in a public forum when I asked her a question, said that regarding the TARP thing, that a banker here told her that people were taking money out of the bank and putting it under their mattresses. And then I believe that she believed the global economy was going to collapse. So that's why she voted for the TARP bailout in September 2008. And the question that I have is, couldn't the Democrats, and these are progressives, Maxine Waters too, same thing. Couldn't the progressive Democrats have said, okay, you need the money for a bailout? Fine. But we're appointing a commission that's going to see to it that the money gets to the people who need it, not to the bankers. And if some banks fail, too bad. And the Brown government in Britain, they actually did the same, something like that, where they gave it the money to the bankers. They said, every penny you have to pass through, and if you don't, we'll nationalize your ass.
Yeah. Amen. I think there, a lot of us in different ways said something like that at the outset, that I didn't, nationalize me has a special meaning which threw people off. The regulators, including the Federal Reserve and the FDIC certainly, all had the authority at that time to take a conservatorship of the biggest banks, not to mention smaller ones, and tell them what to do. That's all you're saying. And so there wasn't any barrier to that. They didn't want to do it, and they were scared that, well, where do we go from there? Because then we have to tell the bankers how to run a good bank, and these guys, we don't want to do that, et cetera, et cetera. But the congresswoman is wrong on the run. There was a run on these banks, but it wasn't by depositors. It was by other banks and mutual funds and others. And they were the ones who set off the panic, because that crisis, when it broke open, revealed to them, holy shit, we've been running this paper around the world for 20 years assuming that these smart guys at the top of the system knew what they were doing. And now we realize it was all a card game. So there was a run, but and local banks, there were exceptions, but on the whole, small independent banks, there are 7,000 of them, were righteous pretty much all the way through. They didn't go crazy in the first place, and they stayed upright throughout. There were some failures, often usually because of collateral problems with the relations with the big banks. But in any case, yeah. And here's another twist. If you read the newspapers, Bank of America is sort of toddling right now, and so are some of the others. Off of Europe, or off of the reality that exists in Wall Street, not just Europe, people, investors have been scared for months, years, that the banks weren't telling the truth, which I happen to think is correct. The Obama administration allowed that. They may find themselves, before this is over, back in another banking crisis, a lot like the first one, except they will have a new complication on this one. Do they dare bail these banks out again? Yeah, well, you're answering the question. And I don't mean that just as a political reality. I mean, you think people are in the streets now.
Yeah.
Imagine, and the people would be right to be in the streets because it would be a colossal broken promise again. I actually have some sympathy for the Federal Reserve because the Federal Reserve is, this has all been dumped in the Fed's lap. And Congress said, we don't know how to solve this, you solve it. And we're going to say in the bill that you're going to abolish too big to fail. Well, how do you want us to do that? Well, we don't know. You're going to have to figure that out. I mean, that's literally what happened, and the president went along with it. So you may be looking at that issue again rather soon.
Right, before you go on, you should read the marked quote there. Just read it out loud.
This is a very revealing moment in American democracy. We're seeing the real deformities and power alignments that govern issues like this, particularly the financial system. All of the power centers in politics and finance and business are discredited by these events. We had this moment, blah, 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 when for complicated political reasons, a majority in the House rose up and said no. Of course, the broad public regards this bailout as a swindle and backwards. The public wonders, why are you giving all this money to the people who caused this crisis and taking money from the public assets of the victims? That was written when? Oh, that was my interview with Amy Goodman, January 29th, 2009. Yeah.
Yeah. We enjoyed it.
Hi, my name is Hans. I would like you to comment, please, on labor productivity, and let me explain. It strikes me that in this nation, from top to bottom, we have a schizophrenic relationship with this thing called productivity. Anytime someone waves out a method to reduce labor inputs to anything, we seem to be unable to resist it. And corporations, of course, celebrate it. And then we turn around and throw our hands up and say, why are people unemployed? When the reason is pretty simple. As consumers, we always want what's cheapest, which means wring all the labor out. And any corporation that forgets that goes on the ash bin. So how do you... And the solution has been to always crank up consumption, which gets us into the growth imperative. So I would like you to comment, please, on the connection between productivity and the growth imperative, if you see one.
Well, that's one of the real dilemmas that's embedded in that question of how does capitalism survive in a world where they have to be sustainable. I think there's an answer to that. But it's not simple, and it does require corporations to develop a new logic of performance. They broke the linkage between labor wages and productivity a long time back. It was really in the 70s, and flowered in the 80s. But my friends at the Fed, the now sainted Paul Volcker, had a lot to do with that. And I said in my Fed book 20 years ago, he never put it this way, but he smashed labor wages in the early 80s, in the Reagan years. People blame other things. And as he was doing that, American corporations, even the best of them, were looking at Asia, Latin America, et cetera, and saying, we're in fight with these other producers now that we didn't anticipate. We thought we'd always be on top. And they took the easy way out. Instead of dealing with questions like you're describing, they moved the jobs to Asia. And low. They did the wage arbitrage, I called it. And they're still doing it. You know, I don't want to start a fight here, but the government for a while owned General Motors. And I'm for bailing General Motors and Chrysler out. I'm for keeping the auto industry, although I think they deserve to die, candidly, on their behavior. But for all the reasons that I'm sure you agree with, But it's like the question about the banks. They had the power to change that company in pretty profound ways. And they didn't want to do that. In fact, they said they wouldn't do that. So I read in the paper or online just last week, the man from GM saying, he's kind of congratulating himself on how well they're doing, and he's saying, we're thinking about moving some of the Volt production to China. Ford said something similar, did they not? I don't know if you're in the auto industry, but I can't remember the specifics. And I thought, wait a minute. That's right in your face. We put that company back on its feet. The UAW took huge hits and made a deal to save the company. And now they're sort of glibly talking about, well, we can make the Volt in China, too. There's no outrage, so maybe I'm misunderstanding what's happening, but it sounds like outrage to me.
We're going to say that the line will go all the way to the last person in line, and that's all we have time for. You're next.
Yeah. I'm Jay Gold. Many years ago in law school, I studied corporation law, and it struck me and strikes me now that there is an entire underpinning of legal doctrine to the corporate power phenomenon you've talked about. You mentioned limited liability. There's also corporate personhood, which many of us have become familiar with through Citizens United, but goes way beyond that. The state action doctrines, so corporations don't have to respect the rights of their workers because private employers aren't subject to the Bill of Rights. State charters, so that there's a race to the bottom, and if California is restrictive, nobody charters there, everybody charters in Delaware, that won't do anything to anybody, and so on. Can you say?
Question?
Yeah. Can you say something about the legal doctrines and how they fit into your analysis and what should be done about it?
Well, you just laid out big pieces of it, and there are more, but I think I was hoping to just tickle everybody's imagination with the possibility that this is not an issue for lawyers. this is an issue, and you've said it, and I was trying to say it.
Jay is also a physician. So
you're clean, yeah. All right, you don't go against the wall first. First are the journalists, and then the lawyers. Maybe we get to the doctors if you haven't. Anyway, see, I think this is a very straightforward and explainable contradiction in our society, and it ought to be dealt with. And I think it's a kind of, if we had, say, 10 or 12 Bernie Sanders in the Senate, we'd have a train to ride, right? We don't yet, but we could have that in a couple of years, a couple of cycles. I'm serious. And they become the party within the party. I don't get me started on the Democratic Party, but, they did have 60 votes. And they did have a majority, an overwhelming majority in the House, and they wouldn't use it. Why not? Why didn't they want to use it? We all know the answer. Anyway, yes, I think these are the debates that in kind of, a complicated, mixed up way were hot arguments in 1885 to 1920. That's where we are. I think we're in a very similar period.
Thank you. My name is Peggy Weierman. I published a book, Connecting the Dots, Government, Community, and Family, with John Nichols, nicely wrote the foreword to, but it has not changed the nation's conversations as of yet. My question to you is, what are the specific either blogs or magazines or other routes you would use to get major points, not to the liberals who already agree with me, but to the independents and moderate Republicans? You have any suggestions?
I don't know. I can't name a publication or even several. Huh?
I'd join the nation.
Yeah, well, I think she was trying to steer us away from that answer in a nice way. But here's something I do believe. And I wrote a little of this in Come Home America. We have allies who are now framed as our enemies in this society. And I mean ordinary, decent folks who happen to be conservative by nature, persuasion, politics, whatever, but who have the same grievances. So I have gently tried to suggest to some of my colleagues at The Nation that we should get into the Tea Party and try to talk to those people. I'm serious. Because, you know, and you have to get by the guys with guns and spanets. But once you do that, you'll find a lot of common interests and complaints. There's a new politics in this. It's hard to do at first, but I that's another thing I think may develop in the next few years, that as the two parties get slammed back and forth by the voters, some of these issues are going to crystallize as not, it'll be stuff that David Brooks says is a center, right? Everything ought to be in the center, or they don't say anything. But it actually will be connecting up people and interests. Another sector like that is small business. And they're held up by the Republicans. Indeed, most of them are Republicans probably, but they get held up as the job creators that we all love and we're going to do. Meanwhile, in different ways, the system is kicking the crap out of them. It is. And they know that. They have been taught and they believe that we're all Reds and we should be locked up or sent away to education. But nevertheless, there's a conversation there. And among other things, I'm told by business people that they know the business roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce does not speak for them. And in fact, throws them over the side on trade and a lot of other issues. Now I'll mention a third one, and this will really get groans. The military. And what I mean is that we need to find a way to begin conversation with military, and I mean from the grunts to the retired four stars or two stars, about what this country's role really ought to be in the world. We saw some of this in Vietnam. We saw a lot more of it in the war in Iraq. Some brave people stood up and told the truth. Most of them, it's true, were either retiring or about to retire. A few of them got their heads handed to them. But and we wrote about them in The Nation and honored them. And there were some civil servants who did the same. That's an opportunity. And I know from friends and personal relations that the military people have a Spartan culture all their own, and they're proud of it, and mostly it works for them. But they do believe in the Constitution and that it's not theirs to decide. But there's a deep sense of betrayal there. And that's dangerous, whichever way it goes. And I don't mean that we're going to talk them out of that anger, but we can show them, look, there's a chance we can actually change the country. And it's a long project, but and it takes some courage to start it. But I think there's promise.
Thanks. Okay. First of all, I was motivated to come up here because of your comments about what you called liberal corporations, which is very personal to me because my father was a GE man for many years back in the 50s and 60s. And also later than that, I worked for a company that was like that claimed to be concerned about the welfare of its employees and making the workday as pleasant as possible. And for the most part, they did a very good job of that until approximately 11 years ago when under new management, they did a 180-degree turnabout, starting to engage in union busting and converting the campus of that corporation essentially into a police state with armed guards, But corporations like that, nonetheless, are very good. They're very slick, and they're very good at maintaining the image of being responsible corporate citizens. For example, if you go out and look on the plaques outside there, you'll see the name of that corporation as being a substantial donor to this building. So that's one thing we have to worry about. Then another point, I may ruffle some feathers here by saying this, but a concern that keeps growing within me is that I come to a meeting like this, I look around, the people here are, by and large, not from the working class. They're not people that have had their homes foreclosed. They're not homeless people. They tend to be people from middle and upper middle class backgrounds.
What would you like Mr. Greider to comment on?
My point is that given that type of an audience, how much real social change is possible from people that have essentially benefited quite lavishly from the capitalist system that they claim to deplore. Thanks.
That sounds like class warfare to me. And I ain't gonna play. You know, I was being quite sincere. I grew up at a dinner table where FDR and Social Security, I was born the year Social Security was enacted, tells you something about me. But it was routine to dismiss Social Security, FDR, and labor unions. My father was a chemist, research director in a manufacturing company, and part of management, therefore. And they weren't nasty people. They were really good people. So they benefited, but I don't think I think that's a dangerous. I just disagree with the logic of somebody got a new car and therefore they got to be Republican or somebody. I don't think it holds up. In any case, our problem is essentially the internal collapse of both political. It would be interesting if my parents were alive today what they would make of this. I think they would be just generally be disgusted. But they did shift to the Democratic Party 40 years ago. They might now be disgusted with the Democrats. I don't know. I think that's too pat, frankly.
Hi, I'm Catherine Capilaro, Wisconsin Progressive. Some people in the room know I have a little obsession with a corporation called Walmart because I feel like it exemplifies all of the things that you're talking about. Predatory expansion, capitalism gone awry, workers treated like crap, and huge public subsidies, including many, many of their workers on public health care, what we have of it. And today they announced that they're no longer going to offer health care to part-time workers, which is the majority of their workforce. So I guess my question to you and to all of us is, what are we going to do about Walmart? If we don't deal with them, we're not going to deal with the problem.
I agree. I don't know whether you will regard this as good news or bad news, but the Chinese are going to deal with Walmart. I'm serious. And here's what I mean by that. Not by choice, but by the dynamics of our situation. The bet Walmart made brilliantly, I have to say, 20, 30 years ago, was that working people and others would come to the big barns for the better prices. And so they had an anti-labor strategy and they had other strategies. And the reason it worked for them is that China was rising as a producer, and China can give you the best price for the obvious reasons we all know. They beat the crap out of their workers and so forth and so on. That's what's coming to an end. And the reason it's coming to an end are deep economic principles playing out. The terms of trade between the U.S. and China are changing because China has risen up so that its workforce, while it's still a huge wage gap, not to mention benefits, But its productivity of that workforce has increased dramatically, and their wages are rising. And so as their workers become more productive and they cost more, then they got to get that from the buyers. That's us. That's Walmart. So, and I'm not the first to say this. I did say it in my last book. Rather soon, we're going to be stuck with the irony that China, which our corporations helped to develop, etc., is now causing U.S. inflation. And that's the way it'll look to people. In fact, it'll be the natural balancing of price and productivity and so forth. And we're, since we're the buyers and the debtors, we're not going to have big choices there. That is why I have argued that for some years, we can't tolerate this imbalance of huge trade deficits every year. Sooner or later, it is going to collapse us. And it's a big part of why we had this debt bubble, because of course people had to borrow. So anyway, I'm not trying to let Walmart off the hook. On the contrary, I think why I've followed their moves too. I think they're sensitive to this, and I think they know they're losing their charm, which their lucky charm was China is going to give us cheap stuff as long as we want it, and I think that's a, you know, if you go back through American history, it's those moments of the opportunities for labor and other interests to really get tough and to drive them to the wall. And the politicians may be at a point where they will either join the fight or at least won't resist.
All right. And if you don't know, Catherine, is this on? Okay. If you don't know, Catherine was gracious enough not to say that she is indeed the author, producer, genius behind Walmartopia, which went all the way to Off-Broadway in New York City and did fantastic work using a little culture there. We've had a great night here with William Greider and
me
with
too.
Our wonderful audience. And I just want to say that the only thing that made it a little bit shorter than it might have been is that our dear friend Midge Miller wasn't with us.
Yeah.
And we miss Midge, who was such a driving force behind the Madison Institute and so many great things in this town, because if Midge had been here, I guarantee you she would have got us started in the William Greider for President discussion. And I think that we all finished tonight off with a great thanks to the memory of Midge Miller, who really made the Madison Institute. A great thanks to Bill Greider, who she always loved and loves from above as we speak. And finally, a great thanks to Connie Trinan for carrying on in the best tradition of Midge Miller and the Madison Institute.
We also...
No, it doesn't seem like it, but you're up.
Okay. The other institution that deserves some thanks, I think, is The Nation magazine. They are the one that gave us the title for this program, and among many other people, these two men. And so we're very happy that you are here tonight and hope you will continue the discussions and the ideas that Bill Greider gave us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.